Once upon a time, not that long ago, one could say that the sun never set on the British Empire. The empire is gone, but the British Commonwealth lives. England is America's mother country. And in our corner of America, British explorers, British expatriates, and others whose roots lay in the empire or Commonwealth are a frequent element of our history. My guests today are three Clatsop County residents whose roots lie in England or the British Commonwealth. Sue Croning lives in Seaside and grew up in Rhodesia, which is present-day Zimbabwe. Valerie Blindhout grew up in England and lives in Astoria, where she is an observer of the civic scene. Patrick Webb grew up in London, lives in Iwako, and is managing editor of the Daily Astorian. Sue Croning, you grew up in a far-flung corner of the Commonwealth, Rhodesia. As a young person, were you conscious of being part of the former British Empire?
Well, Steve, very much so. In fact, I was thinking about this question, and I think that when my parents and other British people like themselves went out to southern Rhodesia, as it was in those days, they actually reinvented the British Empire out there. Now, these people, my father was a chartered accountant. We were sort of what they like to call upper middle class. And a number of such people went out to Rhodesia in those days, the early 50s, on assisted passage. If you had a job, the government paid for you to go out there. And they had come from 6 years of war and another 6 years of austerity with rationing and what have you. And when they got to Rhodesia, they reinvented the British Empire almost, because there was cheap land and there was cheap labor. And so they could have servants. And so they had some leisure, and they recreated the British Empire out there. And my memories of Bulawayo, which is where I grew up, was that it was quite a modern city. It had a club, it was men only, very British. Out in the suburbs, there was a country club, which is where my parents played tennis and golf and had dances and played bridge and did all the sort of things that upper middle class people did before the war.
And how old were you during those years in Rhodesia?
We left when I was 8 years old. My father suffered from asthma, and he was advised to go to a warm climate, and it did do wonders for him. My sister Jill was 6 and my sister Pam was 4.
So you were 8 when you arrived in Rhodesia?
Yes, yes.
And then how old were you when you left?
When I left, I was 36. And we went down to South Africa, and I lived in Johannesburg for 10 years after that.
And so tell us the rest of your story, Sue. Not the rest of your story, but what was your odyssey that ended in Seaside, that led to Seaside?
Well, I lived in Johannesburg for 10 years. I taught mathematics at a private school for boys called St. Stithians. I was fortunate enough there. You know, life is very strange and little odd things will change your life. But my daughter was in the swimming team. She had to be at school at 6 o'clock every morning for practice. And so I went to my school and had an hour or so to spare. And computers were very new in those days. And the school had an Apple computer, which I think cost about $5,000. But I had all this time to get to know the computer. And so I became the computer expert. So I came to the United States to a conference on computers and education. And from there, I really found myself able to get a job over here, which is what I did.
And I will reveal that I've known Sue Croning because I've taken her bridge course in Seaside. She's an excellent teacher. It's an unpaid...
And Steve is an excellent student.
Well, thank you. Thank you, ma'am. It's a challenging game, a fascinating game. But bridge sort of brought you to Seaside, as I remember this story.
Yes, we lived in Phoenix, my husband and I, and we were and still are passionate duplicate bridge players, big part of our life. We wanted to come and live by the ocean, and so we looked online on the internet to see what the bridge scene was like on the Oregon coast, and we found that it was pretty good in Seaside, so that's what brought us here.
I want to go back to Rhodesia before we move to the next our next guest. You know, we've seen the flame trees of Thika and Out of Africa and all the masterpiece theater pieces. And so in your childhood, how were were there holidays that were especially British, shall we say, where the flag was flown and the bands played and that sort of thing happened?
Yes, very much so. At Christmas time, I remember that we would listen to the Queen's speech. Patrick probably remembers the Queen's speech, and we would all sort of sit ramrod straight in our chairs in the living room and listen to the Queen's speech.
On shortwave?
I don't remember, but it was before television. And when the Queen was finished with her speech, they would play God Save the Queen, and we would all stand up for this. There was all the other British holidays were celebrated. I remember when I was about 11, the Queen Mother and one of the princesses came out to Rhodesia, Southern Rhodesia, for what was called the centenary. And that was such a thrill to see the royal family. And we had a massed choir and we all sang Jerusalem. And that was a very big deal for our country.
We'll take a short break. When After Deadline returns, we'll talk with Valerie Lindout about growing up in London. This is After Deadline. I'm Steve Forrester, and we're talking today about all things British. Valerie Lindhout, I believe that Charles Dickens said that if someone is tired of London, he must be tired of life. Tell us about the London of your childhood.
It was fascinating. I was born there, and I was born within the sound of Bow Bells, making me an actual Cockney, which I am, for some reason, very proud of. But I didn't grow up as a child in London. I lived in Hayes, Kent, about half an hour from London by train. But then I worked in London and got to know it fairly well.
And what were those years?
Good heavens, it's 34, 44, 54, 50s.
So it's immediate post-war.
Yes, yes. During the war, of course, that... I have a lapse of memory every now and again. It's like I have to go back there and think. But I enjoyed working in London very much and walking around. And I worked on Fleet Street at one time.
Which is the newspaper, was the newspaper hub.
Yes, yes.
What did you do on Fleet Street?
I worked for a man, his name was F.J. Cam, and he wrote, he was the editor of... Popular Mechanics, I think it was, and he was a very irascible old fellow. I remember he wrote a letter one time, I was taking dictation from him, and he said, he opened it up, he said, "Dear sir, you are a very offensive individual." I enjoyed that very much. Yeah.
How old were you when you left England?
I left in 1958, which would make me 34, 44, 54, 24, 24, 25, yeah.
And why did you leave England?
My father died, and my younger brother decided he wanted to go to Australia, and my mother wanted to follow him, and I did not want to go to Australia. I wanted to come to this. Well, I had met my first husband by that time, and he was an American, and he played tennis, and I played tennis, and I wanted to come here, so I did, and traveled to, my other brother lived in Winnipeg, Canada, and then I came down to California, and I played a lot of tennis growing up. I had sort of forgotten that, but in school and everything, yeah.
Before we continue with your odyssey, I'd like to dwell a little bit on your being in your formative years in post-war London. My late grandmother went there and described that for me, and where it was possible to see places that had been bombed out and that sort of thing. And it must have been somewhat of a, I don't know, you know, when you're young, you tend to take things for granted, and maybe to say, well, I'm looking at history here. How did it all strike you?
Well, where we lived was in a direct line from Germany to London, and the bombers went overhead, and the buzz bombs, which were guided missiles, actually, and they would cut out. So we had an awful time listening, but we didn't. We only had one bomb land really close to us, but we had to run out into the garden shelter. A lot, and it was very disturbing. And my younger brother was born in 1940, so that was very difficult for my mother. So it was harrowing. And then, of course, on the news, we saw the pictures from Germany and the camps and so forth, which were so it sort of seared into my mind, of course.
Yes.
And yeah.
Well, back to your odyssey. So we left off in California. How did you find your way to Astoria?
Stuff happened. And it seemed reasonable to move from where I was, and I didn't really know. And I had friends who moved to Astoria, and Judy Nyland, who is with the Astorian, the Astor Street Opera Company. Yeah, she and her husband at the time moved here, and they liked it very much. And I traveled up here and saw it and liked it as well. So, and that's been a long time now. I really like it.
Okay.
And the time has gone ever so quickly. Yeah.
We'll take another break. When After Deadline returns, we'll talk with Patrick Webb about his English boyhood. Patrick Webb is managing editor of the Daily Astorian. In fact, he's a frequent host of this show. Patrick, in England, there's a test that determines whether a young man or woman goes to a university of education or to what is called a trade school. It must be a defining moment in a young Briton's life. Tell us about that moment in your boyhood.
Well, looking back all those years to 1967-68, when I was in fifth grade, going up to sixth grade, they had an exam called the 11 Plus. And we all took it, everyone took it, and we did practice versions, and then we took the real thing. And it essentially determined your life at that time. I hesitate to say it's still in place, because I haven't really followed too much of a English educational sort of politics and things like that. I do think things have changed. But at that time, the top 10% were sort of creamed off and went to very nice schools called grammar schools. They use the same name as in America, but it's a different version of an American grammar school. And it was a seven-year high school from sixth grade through 12th. And you learnt Latin and got a really good education. And I was really blessed that I was able to scrape through that exam and pass. My brother, who's 4 years older than me and probably a lot smarter, and I'm sure he'd tell you that too, he failed the exam. So with the bottom 90%, he went to a less impressive school, and he left school at 16 and had to go into essentially an apprenticeship program, a retail program. And he was a smart guy. I'd say he was a lot smarter than I was, but he didn't pass the test. And that determined your whole future, because once you were in a certain stream, sort of academic stream, you could then take exams called O-levels and A-levels, which essentially led you in the path to a university education. University educations in England at that time were free, or certainly government supported. There were grants that you could get, but you had to pass quite stringent academic admission standards. So I was blessed to be on that path, whereas my brother was not, and it was all determined at age 11, which, you know, rational thinking people probably right now would think, gee, that's kind of early to be deciding whether a person's going to be a poet or a bricklayer.
So what was the trigger point then that led you toward journalism?
I wasn't tall enough for the police force. They had 5'8" was the police force, and of course I watched the police on TV. But I watched the movies, and Jack Webb in Deadline Midnight, Kirk Douglas in Ace in the Hole, and of course he's the villain of the piece in that one, and all those sort of movies, it just looked glamorous to me. And I was always writing, and I was always reading the paper. I was blessed to be brought up in a mixed household where we had three newspapers every day. My mum took the Daily Mirror, which was the socialist paper. My dad took the Daily Telegraph, which was the second most right-wing paper. And then he brought home from London, because he travelled up to London on the train every day, the Evening Standard, which was a sort of middle-of-the-road paper. So I was always reading these papers and thinking, oh, wouldn't it be great to be reporting the news and stuff like that. So really, I'm one of these people that from probably 8 years old was wanted to be a journalist.
So once you got through the door and you had your first job, what did you find?
Oh, in journalism?
That is to say.
I found that British journalism was heavy on entertainment and in comparison with American journalism, and heavy on entertainment, more entertaining than informing. And there was an ethic that we had, and it was basically, never mind the facts, get on with the story.
That would be a great scene in the movie, wouldn't it?
Yes, sir.
Many in our county know of you, Patrick Webb, through soccer. You referee the sport at high school matches and other matches, and you write about the game in the Daily Asturian. Tell us how soccer entered your life as a young boy in England.
I played for my Cub Scout team, first Fetcham Mole. I was the left winger, and was not particularly good, and I was never picked for the school teams when I went to high school in Surrey, because I was too short, and in PE classes they would divide up the boys for soccer, and the girls would go play netball or field hockey, and they would divide up the boys and pick the teams, and there would always be one left, and it would be me that no one wanted on the team. So really and truly, I was never a great soccer player. I loved the game, and it helped cure me of my asthma. Had very bad asthma. I was a very sick child, nearly died a couple of times, and playing soccer really in PE and things like that really cured me of it helped my lungs grow, and I owe so much to the game because it saved my life, and I suppose that's one of the reasons why I referee as a way of being part of the game and perhaps even giving something back.
This is After Deadline, and after a short break, we'll talk with all three of our guests. This is After Deadline. I'm Steve Forrester, your host, and we're talking about all things British today with three Clatsop County residents who grew up in Britain or parts of the British Empire. Sue Croning of Seaside, Patrick Webb of the Daily Asturian, and Valerie Lindhout of Astoria. I'd like to ask all three of you to have a conversation about two or three things. As the years have passed and you've returned occasionally to England, what strikes you most about the place you came from? Sue, I know you went back recently.
Yeah, this is quite a difficult question for me to answer because I left England when I was 8, and so I really don't feel that familiar with the country or really what goes on there. I do visit quite frequently because my son lives there and I went to a family wedding recently. England always seems to me to be very crowded, lots of traffic, but very beautiful. I love the cultural aspects of it, the history. I always find fascinating, but I think one of the others is in a better position than I am to talk about that, to answer that question.
Well, let me ask you this, though, however. You've lived in this country quite a while.
I have, 22 years.
And so do you feel as though you're stepping back in time when you go there, technologically or culturally, or is it almost like you're a traveler, or is it like you're returning to something that is out of a photo album that you once were in?
Yes, it's almost to me like a foreign country. I don't really feel any more at home in England than I do, say, in Europe. I do find that, as a British person, I found the United States incredibly welcoming to me. I felt embraced by the American people. It was so easy to fit in here, to make a life, make friends. I don't have that experience in England so much, and neither do my children. They tend to rather just mix with other South Africans and other Zimbabwean people. And I don't know what Patrick would say about that, but...
Well, what would Patrick say? I know, Patrick, you go back annually, I would say, to see your parents, and how do you find your former home?
Well, gosh, I hesitate to say this as this is being broadcast, but I find them rather backward, to be honest with you. Gosh, there I am, they're going to take away my passport. I'm glad I live in America. I love America. America has embraced me in the same way that it has embraced Sue. It's given me wonderful opportunities to in my career and also in hobbies and activities and things like that. And I do feel like I'm stepping back in time. But the biggest difference is in attitude. And I don't know if other ladies have found this when they've embraced certain American beliefs. And the biggest difference is in America, if something's wrong, we form a committee or we complain, or like Valerie, she'll write a letter to the editor of the newspaper, and we may get something changed, but we'll at least get the issue exposed. In England, there's a belief that you can't change anything. Everything's set in stone, and you can't make a difference. And that attitude, frankly, I don't buy into that. And my relatives find me rather sort of aggressive and assertive in, they say, you Yanks think you can change the world. And it's like, well, yes, we can, you know. You should try it sometime, you know.
Yeah. Valerie, do you go back regularly?
No, I don't. I did go back one time when my children were young, and I had that impression, that exact impression, though, of, it was almost like stepping into an album of some kind. I think you said that just now.
Photo album.
Yes. And I think also the notion, the hierarchical English attitude, and of course we have the monarchy and then on down,
yes,
which I was so glad to leave. Mm-hmm. And of course finding somewhat of the same here, because human nature is human nature after all. But... I enjoy listening to English people. It's somehow the word quaint comes to mind, but that's been quite a long time ago now, and there are an awful lot of good things still coming. I'm proud to be British. Born.
I shared with Patrick Webb, who's my coworker, watching on C-SPAN the British prime minister candidates debating, the first time I guess they've done that. And it was so remarkable because they were all so prepared, because that's part of the British preparatory system. You didn't hold your breath to see if any of them were going to flub. And speaking of politics, England and the U.S. are constant companions on the world stage. Have you reflected on the nature of our cultural relationship, our two countries, now that you're sort of Americans? I know Mr. Webb has.
Well, I'll defer to Sue. What were you going to say, Sue?
No, that's rather a difficult question for me.
I find one thing that I found that was very interesting during the recent general election debacle that came up in England, that I followed a little bit more closely than I did some other news, was that there's always this talk of this special relationship that England and America has, and you alluded to it in your introduction, but I think it's less and less these days. I think there's a whole generation growing up in this country and in England that doesn't think that there's a special relationship. In fact, I believe it was the third party candidate leader in England, the Liberal Democrat chap that was working with the Conservative to form the government. He said he thinks the new special relationship should be England and India because of whatever he's seen in his crystal ball. So I think less and less. I think Reagan and Thatcher were really the last ones to buy into that concept.
Valerie, you're fairly outspoken on political matters, and what's your observation of the U.S. England relationship?
I don't know. It's ever so interesting to me to hear other people saying something about it. I'm awfully, awfully glad to be American. I can say that. And again, the narrow focus of the Brits sometimes is disturbing in its way. And I don't know. I really honestly don't know. Patrick has a better idea. It sounds very real to me what he's saying about the relationship. But I think we're all countries and people are gradually becoming more one, which is what this country is about in the first place.
Valerie, in an earlier comment, you mentioned the monarchy and the class consciousness, and you're absolutely right. There are classes in America as well, but we don't have a monarchy. And it has struck me that the monarchy, in a sense, prolongs a state of adolescence. I see you shaking your head. Yes, please pick up on that point.
Yes, it is. It's the father knows best, that all that spirit of things, which isn't, I suppose it was necessary for survival then, but we have to be equal. We have to be equal. And
A lot of British people wouldn't agree with you on that, though, back in England. I mean, the three of us perhaps in the room and studio here would agree, but a lot of British people don't think, well, we're not equal. We can't possibly be equal.
And that is the narrow confines of that mind, and in this country it is expanding, and recent events are expanding things even more, I'm so happy to say. Mm-hmm. Very recent, this.
And I think Patrick made a very good point about how in America there's the attitude that you can change things. Mm. It was one of the things I most admired about the country when I came here, particularly from Africa, where so many things you just feel you can't change. And I think that's one of the big differences, and the monarchy is part of that. And their traditions, they hold on to their traditions, they hold on to their old buildings. All these things do tend to keep them back a little bit, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
They tend to miss the race. I mean, if you ask an American about the marathon, they'll say, well, it's 26 miles. And if they're really a clever American, they'll say it's 26 miles, 385 yards. And if you ask an English person, they'll say, well, that was a battle back in 490 BC between Persia and Athens. And then they'll go on about something that happened way in the past. So it's... I think we're all three of us agree that we... And perhaps I can't speak for us, but we all have gained something huge from our British heritage, but we've chosen to move on. We've had a wonderful experience being embraced by American society wherever we've been.
The best of both worlds.
Yes. Well, thank you for joining me today in this discussion. Sue Croning of Seaside, Patrick Webb of the Daily Astorian, Valerie Lindhout of Astoria. This has been After Deadline. We've been talking about the British Commonwealth.